his child. She would not have dared to take those measures if she had not been Erlan's wife and had grown accustomed to acting fearlessly, even when her heart trembled with anguish. Her tear-streaked smile when she woke him up and said the boy was calling for his father. A smile of such heartbreaking sweetness was possible only for someone who knew what it meant both to lose a battle and to win. It was Erlan's wife whom he loved. The way he loved her now. But that meant his love was sinful. And that was why things stood as they did and why he was unhappy. He was so unhappy that sometimes he felt only a great astonishment that he was the one this had befallen, and that he could see no way out of his distress. When he trampled on his own honor and noble decorum and reminded Erling Vidkunsson of things that no honorable man would have imagined that he knew, he had done it not for his brothers or kinsmen, but for her alone. It was for her sake that he had dared plead with the other man, just like the lepers who begged at the church doors in town, displaying their hideous sores. He had thought that someday he would tell her about it. Not everything, not how deeply he had humbled himself. But after they had both grown old, he thought that he would say to Kristen, "I helped you as best I could because I remembered how sincerely I loved you, back when I was your betrothed." But there was one thing he didn't dare touch on with his thoughts. Had Erlan said anything to Kristen? Yes. He had thought that one day she should hear it from his own lips. "I never forgot that I loved you when we were young." But if she already knew, and if she had learned it from her husband, no. Then he didn't think he could go on. He had intended to tell only her. Someday, a long time from now. Then he thought about that moment when he had revealed it himself, when Erland unwittingly happened to see what he thought he had hidden in the most secret part of his soul. And Romborg knew, although he didn't understand how she had found out. His own wife and her husband. They both knew. Simon gave a wild, stifled scream and abruptly flung himself onto the other side of the bed. May God help him. Now he was the one who lay here, flayed naked, violated, bleeding with torment, and trembling with shame. The proprietress peeked around the door and met Simon's feverish, dry, and sharply glittering eyes from the bed.
"Didn't you sleep? Erlan Nikolausen was just riding past with two men. No doubt two of his sons were traveling with him."
Simon mumbled something in reply, angry and incomprehensible. He wanted to give them a good head start, but he too would soon have to see about setting off for home. As soon as Simon entered the main house at Formo and took off his outer garments, Andres would seize hold of his leather cap and try it on. While the boy straddled the bench and rode off to see his uncle at Diefrin, the big cap would slip down, first over his small nose and then back over his lovely blonde curls. But it did little good for Simon to try to remember such things now. God only knew when the boy would be visiting his uncle at Diefrin again. Instead, the memory of his other son rose up, Hofrid's child, the tiny pale blue body of an infant. He had seen little of the boy during the few days he lived. He had to sit at the bedside of the dying mother. If the child had survived, or if he had lived longer than his mother, then Simon would have kept Manvik. Then he probably would have looked for a new wife there in the south. Occasionally he might have come north to the valley to see to his estate up here. Then surely he would have not forgotten Kristen. She had led him into much too strange a dance for him to do that. By the devil, a man should be allowed to remember it as a peculiar adventure, that he had been forced to rescue his betrothed, a high-born young maiden, reared in Christian and seemly behavior, from a house of ill repute and another man's bed. But then he wouldn't have been able to think of her in such a way that it troubled him and robbed the taste from everything good that life had to offer. his son Erling. He would have been 14 winters old by now. When Andres one day reached so near the age of a man, he himself would be old and feeble. Oh yes, Hofrid. You weren't very happy with me, were you? I'm not entirely without blame that things have gone as they have for me. Erland Nikolausen might well have had to pay with his life for his impetuousness. And Kristen would now be living as a widow at Urengard. And he himself might have then regretted that he was a married man. Nothing seemed so foolish anymore that he didn't think himself capable of it. The wind had died down, but great wet flakes of springtime snow were still falling when Simon rode out of the alehouse courtyard. And now, toward evening, birds began whistling and warbling in the grove of trees, defying the snowfall. Just as a gash in the skin can reopen from too sudden a movement, a fleeting memory caused him pain. Not long ago, at his Easter banquet, several guests were standing outside, basking in the midday sun. High above them in the birch tree sat a robin, whistling into the warm blue air. Germund came limping around the corner of the house, dragging himself along with his cane, his other hand resting on the shoulder of his oldest son. He looked up, stopped, and imitated the bird. The boy also pursed his lips and whistled. They could mimic nearly all the bird songs. Kristen was standing a short distance away with several other women. Her smile had been so charming as she listened. Now, towards sunset, the clouds began to disperse in the west, tumbling golden over the white mountain slopes, filling the passes and small valleys like gray mist. The river gleamed dully like brass. The dark currents, free of ice, rushed around the rocks in the riverbed, and on each rock lay a little white pillow of new snow. They made slow progress on the weary horses through the heavy snow. It was a milky white night with a full moon, which peeked out from the drifting haze and clouds as Simon rode down the slopes to the Ula River. When he had crossed the bridge and reached the flat expanses of pine forest through which the winter road passed, the horses began moving faster. They knew they were approaching the stable. Simon patted Digerbein's steaming wet neck. He was glad this journey would soon be over. Romborg had probably gone to bed long ago. At the place where the road turned sharply and emerged from the woods, there stood a small house. He was nearly upon it when he noticed that men on horseback were stopped in front of the door. He heard Erland's voice shout, "Then it's agreed that you'll come to visit the day after Sunday. Can I tell my wife as much?" Simon called out a greeting. It would seem much too strange not to stop and continue on in their company, but he told Sigurd to ride on ahead. Then he rode over to join them. It was Nokva and Gauta. Erland was just stepping out of the entryway. They greeted each other again, the three others in a somewhat strained fashion. Simon could see their faces, although not very clearly in the fading light. He thought their expressions seemed uncertain, both tense and begrudging at the same time, so he said at once, "I've come from Dyfrin, my brother-in-law." "Yes, I heard that you had traveled south." Erland stood with his hand on the saddle bow, his eyes downcast. "You've made good time," he added, as if the silence were uncomfortable. "No, wait a bit," said Simon to the young boys who were about to ride off. "You should hear this too. It was my brother's seal that you saw on the letter, Gauta. And I know you must think they showed poor loyalty to your father, both he and the other gentlemen who had affixed their seals on the letter to Prince Håkon, which your father was to carry to Denmark." The boy looked down in silence. Erland said, "There was one thing you probably didn't think about, Simon, when you went to see your brother. I paid dearly for the safety of Gerd and the others who joined me. It cost me all I owned, except for my reputation as a loyal man who keeps his word. Now, Gerd Dara must think that I couldn't save even my reputation. Shamefully, Simon bowed his head. He hadn't thought about that. You might have told me this, Erlan, when I said that I was going to Difrin. You must have seen for yourself that I was so desperate and furious that I was beyond thinking or reasoning when I rode away from your manor. I wasn't particularly level-headed myself, Erlan. No, but I thought you might have had time to come to your senses during the long ride. And I couldn't very well ask you not to talk to your brother without revealing things I had sworn a sacred oath to conceal.
Simon fell silent for a moment. At first, he thought that Erlan was right. But then it occurred to him. No, Erlan was being quite unreasonable. Was he supposed to submit to having Kristen and the boys think so ill of him? He mentioned this rather vehemently.
I have never uttered a word about this, kinsman. Not to my mother or to my brothers, said Gauta, turning his handsome, fair face toward his uncle.
But in the end, they found out about it just the same, replied Simon obstinately. I thought, after everything that happened on that day at my estate, we needed to clear up the matter. And I don't understand why it should take your father so unawares. You're still not much older than a child, my Gauta. And you were so young when you were mixed up in this secret plot. Surely I should be able to trust my own son, replied Erland angrily. And I had no other choice when I needed to save the letter. I either had to give it to Gauta or let the sheriff find it.
Simon thought it pointless to discuss the matter any further. But he couldn't resist saying, I wasn't happy when I heard what the boy has been thinking of me these past 4 years. I've always been fond of you, Gauta. The boy urged his horse forward a few paces and stretched out his hand. Simon saw that his face had darkened, as if he were blushing.
You must forgive me, Simon.
Simon clasped the boy's hand. At times, Gauta looked so much like his grandfather that Simon felt strangely moved. He was rather bow-legged and slight in build, but he was an excellent rider, and on the back of a horse he was as handsome a youth as any father could want. All four of them began riding north. The boys were in front, and when they were beyond earshot, Simon continued,
You must understand, Erlan. I don't think you can rightfully blame me for seeking out my brother and asking him to tell me the truth about this matter. But I know that you had reason to be angry with me, both you and Kristen. Because as soon as this strange news came out, he fumbled for words. What Gauta said about my seal. I can't deny that I thought. I know both of you believed that I thought. What I should have had sense enough to realize was unthinkable. So I can't deny that you have reason to be angry, he repeated.
The horses splashed through the slushy snow. It took a moment before Erland replied, and then his voice sounded gentle and subdued.
I don't know what else you could have thought. It was almost inevitable that you should believe.
Oh, no. I should have known it wasn't possible.
Simon interrupted, sounding aggrieved. After a moment, he asked,
Did you think that I knew about my brothers? That I tried to help you for their sake?
No,
said Erland in surprise. I realized you couldn't possibly know. I knew that I hadn't said anything, and I thought I could safely rely on your brothers not to talk.
He laughed softly. Then he grew somber and said gently,
I knew you did it for the sake of our father-in-law, and because you're a good man.
Simon rode on in silence for a while.
I imagine you must have been bitterly angry, he then said. Well, when I had time to think about it, I didn't see that there was any other way you could interpret things.
What about Kristen? Asked Simon, his voice even lower.
Kristen?
Erland laughed again.
You know she won't stand for anyone censuring me, except for herself. She seems to think she can handle that well enough all alone. It's the same with our children. God save me if I should chastise them with a single word. But you can rest assured that I've brought her around.
You have?
Yes, well,
with time I'll manage to convince her.
You know that once Kristen gives it some thought, she's the sort of person who will remember you've shown us such loyal friendship that...
Simon, agitated and distraught, felt his heart trembling. He found it unbearable. The other man seemed to think that they could now dismiss this matter from their minds. In the pale moonlight, Erlon's face looked so genuinely peaceful. Simon's voice quavered with emotion as he spoke again.
Forgive me, Erlund, but I don't see how I could have believed. I told you, I understand it.
The other broke in rather impatiently.
It seems to me that you couldn't have thought anything else.
If only those two foolish children had never spoken, said Simon heatedly.
Yes, Gauta has never received such a beating before in his life. And the whole thing started because they were quarreling about their ancestors, Rydar Birkevein and King Skula and Bishop Nikolaus.
Erlan shook his head.
But let's not think about this anymore, kinsman. It's best if we forget about it as soon as we can.
I can't do that.
But Simon.
This was spoken in reproach, with mild astonishment.
It's not worth it to take this so seriously.
I can't.
Don't you understand? I'm not as good a man as you are.
Erlund gave him a bewildered look.
I don't know what you mean. I'm not as good a man as you are. I can't so easily forgive those I have wronged.
I don't know what you mean, repeated Erlund in the same tone of voice.
I mean...
Simon's face was contorted with pain and desperation. His voice was low, as if he were stifling an urge to scream out the words.
I mean that I've heard you speaking kindly of Judge Sigurd of Steigen, the old man whose wife you stole. I've seen how you loved Lavrans with all the love of a son. And I've never noticed that you bore any grudge toward me because you enticed my betrothed away from me. I'm not as noble-minded as you think, Erlan. I'm not as noble-minded as you are. I do bear a grudge toward the man whom I have wronged.
His cheeks flecked with white from the strain, Simon stared into the eyes of his companion. Erlund had listened to him with his mouth agape.
I've never realized this until now.
Do you hate me, Simon? He whispered, overwhelmed.
Don't you think I have reason to do so?
Unawares, both men had reined in their horses. They sat and stared at each other. Simon's small eyes glittered like steel. In the hazy white light of the night, he saw that Erlund's lean features were twitching as if something had broken inside him. An awakening. He looked up from beneath half-closed lids, biting his quivering lower lip.
I can't bear to see you anymore, said Simon. But that was 20 years ago, man, exclaimed Erlund, overcome and confused.
Yes, but don't you think she's worth thinking about for 20 years? Erlund pulled himself erect in the saddle. He met Simon's eyes with a steady, open gaze. The moonlight lit a blue-green spark in his big, pale blue eyes.
Yes. Yes, I do. May God bless her.
For a moment he sat motionless. Then he spurred his horse and galloped off through the puddles so the water sprayed up behind him. Simon held Digerbein back. He was almost thrown to the ground because he reined in the horse so sharply. He waited there at the edge of the woods, struggling with a restless animal, for as long as he could hear hoofbeats in the slush. Remorse had overwhelmed him as soon as he said it. He felt regret and shame, as if in senseless anger he had struck the most defenseless of creatures, a child or a delicate, gentle, and witless beast. His hatred felt like a shattered lance. He was shattered himself from the confrontation with the man's foolish innocence. That bird of misfortune, Erlan Nikolausen, understood so little that he seemed both helpless and without guile. Simon swore and cursed to himself as he rode. Without guile. The man was well past 40. It was about time that he could handle a conversation man to man.
If Simon had wounded himself, then by the devil it should be considered worth the price if for once he had managed to strike Erland a blow. Now he was riding home to her.
May God bless her,
Simon thought ruefully. And so it was over. The plodding around in that sibling love. The two of them over there, and he and his family. He would never have to meet Kristin Lavran's daughter again. The thought took his breath away. Just as well, by the devil. If your eye offends you, then pluck it out, said the priests. He told himself that the main reason he had done this was to escape the sister-brother love with Kristin. He couldn't bear it anymore. He had only one wish now, that Romborg would not be awake when he came home. But when he rode in among the fences, he saw someone wearing a dark cloak standing beneath the aspen trees. The white of her wimple gleamed. She said that she had been waiting for him ever since Sigurd returned home. The maids had gone to bed, so Romborg herself ladled up the porridge that stood on the edge of the hearth, keeping warm. She placed bacon and bread on the table and brought in newly tapped ale. Shouldn't you go to bed now, Romborg? Asked her husband as he ate. Romborg did not reply. She went over to her loom and began threading the colorful little balls of wool in and out of the warp. She had set up the loom for a tapestry before Christmas, but she hadn't made much progress yet. Erland rode past, heading north, some time ago, she said with her back turned. From what Sigurd said, I thought you would be riding together. No, it didn't turn out that way. Erland had a greater longing for his bed than you did? She laughed a little. When she received no answer, she said again, I suppose he always longs to be home with Kristin when he has been away. Simon was silent for a good while before he replied, Erland and I did not part as friends. Romborg turned around abruptly. Then he told her what he had learned at Diefrin and about the first part of the conversation with Erland and his sons. It seems to me rather unreasonable that you should quarrel over such a matter when you've been able to remain friends until now. Perhaps. But that's how things went. And it will take too long to discuss the whole matter tonight. Romborg turned back to her loom and busied herself with her work.
Simon, she said suddenly, do you remember a story that Sira Eirik once told us? From the Bible? About a maiden named Abishag the Shunammite?
No.
Back when King David was old and his vigor and manhood were beginning to fade, Romborg began, but Simon interrupted her.
My Romborg, it's much too late at night. This is no time to start telling sagas. And now I do remember the story about the woman you mentioned.
Romborg pushed up the reed of the loom and fell silent for a while. Then she spoke again. Do you remember the saga my father knew? About the handsome Tristan and fair Isolde and dark Isolde?
Yes, I remember.
Simon pushed his plate aside, wiped the back of his hand across his mouth and got up. He went over to stand in front of the fireplace. With one foot resting on the edge, his elbow on his knee, and his chin in his hand, he stared into the fire, which was about to die out inside the stone-lined hollow. From the loom over in the corner came Romborg's voice, fragile-sounding and close to tears. When I listened to those stories, I always thought that men like King David and Sir Tristan, it seemed to me so foolish and cruel. That they didn't love the young brides who offered them their maidenhood and the love of their hearts with gentleness and seemly graciousness, but preferred instead such women as Fru Bathsheba or fair Isolde, who had squandered themselves in other men's arms. I thought that if I had been a man, I wouldn't have been so lacking in pride or so heartless.
Overcome, she fell silent.
It seems to me the most terrible fate. What happened to Abishag and poor Isolde of Bretland?
Abruptly she turned around, walked quickly across the room, and stood before her husband. What is it, Romborg? Simon reluctantly asked in a low voice. I don't know what you mean by all this.
Yes, you do, she replied fiercely. You're a man just like that Tristan.
I find it hard to believe, he tried to laugh, that I should be compared with the handsome Tristan. And the two women you mentioned. If I remember right, they lived and died as pure maidens, untouched by their husbands.
He looked at his wife. The little triangle of her face was pale, and she was biting her lip.
Simon set his foot down, straightened up, and put both hands on her shoulders. My Romborg, you and I have two children, he said softly. She didn't reply. I've done my best to show you my gratitude for that gift. I thought, I've tried to be a good husband to you.
When she didn't speak, he let her go, went over to a bench, and sat down.
Romborg followed and stood before him, looking down at her husband. His broad thighs in the wet, muddy hose, his stout body, his heavy, reddish-brown face. Her lip curled with displeasure.
You've grown so ugly over the years, Simon.
Well, I've never thought myself to be a handsome man, he said calmly.
But I'm young and pretty.
She sat down on his lap, the tears pouring from her eyes as she held his head in her hands.
Simon, look at me. Why can't you reward me for this? Never have I wanted to belong to anyone but you. It's what I dreamed of ever since I was a little maiden, that my husband would be a man like you. Do you remember how we were once allowed to follow along with you, both Ulvil and I? You were going with father to the west pasture to look at his foals. You carried Ulvil over the creek, and father was going to lift me up, but I cried that I wanted you to carry me too. Do you remember?
Simon nodded. He remembered paying a great deal of attention to Ulvil because he thought it so sad that the lovely child was crippled. Of the youngest daughter he had no memory, except that he knew there was a girl younger than Ulvil.
You had the most beautiful hair.
Romborg ran her fingers through the lock of wavy light brown hair that fell over her husband's forehead.
And there's still not a single streak of gray.
Erlan's hair will soon be as much white as black.
And I always loved to see the deep dimples in your cheeks when you smiled. And the fact that you had such a merry voice.
Yes. No doubt I looked a little better back then than I do now.
No, she whispered fiercely. When you look at me tenderly, do you remember the first time I slept in your arms? I was in bed, whimpering over a toothache. Father and mother were asleep, and it was dark in the loft. But you came over to the bench where we lay, Ulvil and I, and asked me why I was crying. You told me to hush and not wake the others. Then you lifted me in your arms. You lit a candle and cut a splinter of wood, and then poked at my gums around the aching tooth until you drew blood. Then you said a prayer over the splinter, and the tooth didn't hurt anymore. And I was allowed to sleep in your bed, and you held me in your arms.
Simon placed his hand on her head, pressing it to his shoulder. Now that she spoke of it, he remembered. It was when he had come to Urengard to tell Lavrans that the bond between him and Kristen had to be broken. He had slept very little that night. And now he recalled that he had gotten up to tend to little Romborg, who lay fretting over a toothache. Have I ever behaved toward you in such a way, my Romborg, that you thought it right to say that I didn't love you?
Simon, don't you think I might deserve that you loved me more than Kristen? She was wicked and dishonest toward you, while I have stayed with you like a little lapdog all these years.
Gently, Simon lifted her off his lap, stood up, and took her hands in his.
Speak no more of your sister, Romborg. Not in that manner. I wonder whether you even realize what you're saying. Don't you think that I fear God? Can you believe that I would be so unafraid of shame and the worst of sins, or that I wouldn't think of my children and all my kinsmen and friends? I'm your husband, Romborg. Don't forget that. and don't talk of such things to me.
I know you haven't broken any of God's commandments or breached any laws of code or honor.
Never have I spoken a word to your sister or touched her with my hand in any way that I cannot defend on the day of judgment. This I swear before God and the Apostle Saint Simon.
Romborg nodded silently.
Do you think your sister would have treated me as she has all these years if she thought, as you do, that I love her with sinful desire? Then you don't know Kristen.
Oh, she has never thought about whether any man might desire her, except for Erlan. She hardly notices that the rest of us are flesh and blood.
Yes. What you say is probably true, Romborg, replied Simon calmly. But then you must realize how senseless it is for you to torment me with your jealousy.
Romborg pulled her hands away.
I didn't mean to do so, Simon. But you've never loved me the way you love her. She is still always in your thoughts, but you seldom think of me unless you see me.
I'm not to blame, Romborg. If a man's heart is created in such a fashion that whatever is inscribed on it when it's young and fresh is carved deeper than all the runes that are later etched.
Haven't you ever heard the saying that a man's heart is the first thing to come alive in his mother's womb and the last thing to die inside him?
Replied Romborg quietly. No. Is there such a saying? That might well be true.
Lightly he caressed her cheek.
But if we're going to get any sleep tonight, we should go to bed now, he said wearily.
Romborg fell asleep after a while. Simon slipped his arm out from under her neck, moved over to the very edge of the bed, and pulled the fur covers all the way up to his chin. His shirt was soaked through at the shoulder from her tears. He felt a bitter sympathy for his wife, but at the same time he realized with renewed bewilderment that he could no longer treat her as if she were a blind and inexperienced child. Now he had to acknowledge that Romborg was a full-grown woman. Gray light appeared in the window pane. The May night was fading. He was dead tired, and tomorrow was the Sabbath. He wouldn't go to church in the morning, even though he might need to. He had once promised Lavrans that he would never miss a mass without an exceedingly good reason. But it hadn't helped him much to keep that promise during all these years, he thought bitterly. Tomorrow he was not going to ride to mass.
Part 2. Debtors. Chapter 1. Kristen did not hear a full account of what had happened between Erland and Simon. Her husband told her and Björgulf what Simon had said about his journey to Dieffryn, and he said that afterward they had exchanged words and ended up parting as foes.
I can't tell you any more than that.
Erland was rather pale, his expression firm and resolute. She had seen him look that way only a few times before, in all the years she had been married to him. She knew that this was something he would refuse to discuss any further. She had never liked it when Erland countered her questions with that expression. God only knew she didn't consider herself more than a simple woman. She would have preferred to avoid taking responsibility for anything but her own children and her household duties. And yet she had been forced to deal with so many things that seemed to her more appropriate concerns for a man to handle. But Erland had thought it quite reasonable to let them rest on her shoulders. So it didn't suit him to act so overbearing and to rebuff her when she wanted to know about things that he had undertaken on his own that would affect the welfare of them all. She took this enmity between Erland and Simon Dara greatly to heart. Romborg was her only sister, and when she thought about losing Simon's companionship, she realized for the first time how fond she had become of this man and how much gratitude she owed him. His loyal friendship had been the best support she had in her difficult situation. She knew that now people would be talking about this all over the countryside, that the folks of Urundgard had quarreled with Simon of Formo too. Simon and Romborg were liked and respected by everyone.
but most people regarded Kristen, her husband, and her sons with suspicion and ill will. This was something she had noticed long ago. Now they would be so alone. Kristen felt as if she would sink into the earth from sorrow and shame on that first Sunday when she arrived at the green in front of the church and saw Simon standing a short distance away among a group of farmers. He greeted her and her family with a nod, but it was the first time he didn't come over to shake hands and talk with them. Romborg did come over to her sister and took her hand.
It's dreadful that our husbands have fallen into discord. But you and I need not quarrel because of that.
She stood on her toes to kiss Kristen so that everyone in the churchyard could see it. Kristen wasn't sure why, but she seemed to sense that Romborg was not as sad as she might have been. She had never liked Erlan. God only knew whether she had set her husband against him, intentionally or not. And yet Romborg always came over to greet her sister whenever they met at church. Ulvild asked in a loud voice why her aunt didn't come south to visit them anymore. Then she ran over to Erlan to cling to him and his oldest sons. Arnyard stood quietly at her stepmother's side, took Kristen's hand, and looked embarrassed. Simon and Erlan, along with his sons, vigilantly avoided each other. Kristen greatly missed her sister's children as well. She had grown fond of the two maidens. One day, when Romborg brought her son to Mass, Kristen kissed Andres after the service and then burst into tears. She loved this tiny, frail boy so dearly. She couldn't help it, but now that she no longer had any small children of her own, it was a comfort to her to look after this little nephew from Formo and pamper him whenever his parents brought him along to Jorungarde. From Gauta, she learned a little more about the matter, because he told her what words were spoken between Erland and Simon on the night when they met at Shinfeld Gudrun's hut. The longer Kristen thought about it, the more it seemed to her that Erland was most at fault. She had felt bitter toward Simon, because he ought to have known his kinsmen well enough to realize that Erland would not have betrayed and deceived his brother in any dishonorable way, no matter how many strange things he might do out of recklessness or on impulse. And whenever Erlan saw what he had done, he usually behaved like a skittish stallion that has torn its reins loose and become wild with fright at what is dragging along behind. But Erlan never seemed to understand that sometimes other people needed to protect their own interests in the face of the mischief that he had such a rare talent for stirring up. Then Erland would fail to guard his tongue or watch how he behaved. She remembered from her own experience, back when she was still young and tender, time after time she had felt as if he were trampling on her heart with his reckless behavior. He had driven away his own brother. Even before Gunnulf entered the monastery, he had withdrawn from them. And she knew that Erland was to blame. He had so often offended his pious and worthy brother, even though Gunnulf had never done anything but good for Erland, as far as she knew. Now he had pushed Simon away. And when she wanted to know what had caused this animosity between him and their only friend, Erland merely gave her a stubborn look and said he couldn't tell her. She could see that he had told Nokva more. Kristen felt dismayed and uneasy when she noticed that Erland and her eldest son would fall silent or change the topic of their conversation as soon as she came near. And this was not a rare occurrence. Gauta and Lavrans and Munan kept closer to their mother than Nikolaus had ever done, and she had always talked more to them than to him. And yet she still felt that of all her children, her firstborn son was in some sense closest to her heart. After she had returned to live at Jorungarde, memories of the time when she bore this son under her heart and gave birth to him became strangely vivid and alive. For she noticed in so many ways that the people of Seal had not forgotten the sins of her youth. It was almost as if they felt she had tarnished the honor of the entire region when she, daughter of the man who was regarded as their chieftain, had gone astray. They had not forgiven her, or the fact that she and Erland had added mockery to Lavran's sorrow and shame when they fooled him into giving away a seduced maiden with the grandest wedding that had ever been seen in Gudbrandsdal. Kristin didn't know whether Erland realized that people had begun gossiping about these old subjects again. If he did, he probably paid them no mind. He considered her neighbors no more than homespun farmers and fools, every one of them. And he taught his sons to think the same. It pained her soul to know that these people who had wished her so well back when she was Lavrans Björgulfsson's pretty daughter, the Rose of the Northern Valley, now despised Erland Nicolason and his wife and judged them harshly. She didn't plead with them. She didn't weep because she had become a stranger among them. But it hurt nevertheless. And it seemed as if even the steep mountains surrounding the valley that had sheltered her childhood now looked differently at her and her home. Black with menace and stone gray, with a fierce determination to subdue her. Once she had wept bitterly. Erland knew about it, and he had had little patience with her back then. When he discovered that she had walked alone for many months with the burden of his child under her frightened, sorrowful heart, he did not take her in his arms and console her with tender and loving words. He was bitter and ashamed that it would come out how dishonorably he had acted toward Lavrans. But he hadn't thought about how much more difficult it would be for her on that day, when she stood in disgrace before her proud and loving father. And Erland had not greeted his son with much joy when she finally brought the child into the light of life. That moment when her soul was released from endless anguish and dread and torment, and she saw the hideous, shapeless fruit of her sin come alive under the fervent prayers of the priest and become the most beloved and healthy of children. Then it felt as if her heart would melt with humble joy, and even the hot, defiant blood of her body turned to sweet, white, innocent milk. Yes, with God's help, the boy would doubtless become a man, Erland had said as she lay in bed, wanting him to rejoice with her over this precious treasure, which she could hardly bear to let out of her arms when the women wanted to tend to the child. He loved the children he had by Elina Orm's daughter. That much she had both seen and sensed, but when she carried Nokva over to Erland and tried to place him in his father's arms, Erland wrinkled his nose and asked what he was supposed to do with this infant who leaked from both ends. For years, Erland would only grudgingly look at his eldest lawfully born son, unable to forget that Nokva had come into the world at an inopportune time. And yet the boy was such a handsome and good and promising child that any father would rejoice to see such a son grow up to succeed him. From the time he was quite little, Nokva loved his father so dearly that it was wondrous to behold. His whole small, fair face would light up like the sun whenever his father took him on his knee for a moment and spoke a few words to him, or he was allowed to hold his father's hand to cross the courtyard. Steadfastly, Nokva had courted his father's favor during that time when Erland was more fond of all his other children than the eldest. Björgulf was his father's favorite when the boys were small, and occasionally Erland would take his sons along to the armory when he went up there. That was where all the armor and weapons were kept that were not in daily use at Husaby. While his father talked and bantered with Björgulf, Nokva would sit quietly on top of a chest, simply breathing with happiness because he was allowed to be there. But as time passed and Björgulf's poor eyesight meant that he could not accompany Erland as readily as his other sons, and Björgulf also grew more taciturn and withdrawn, things changed. Erland began to seem almost a little embarrassed in the boy's presence. Kristin wondered whether Björgulf, in his heart, blamed his father for destroying their well-being and taking his son's future with him when he fell, and whether Erland knew or guessed as much. However that might be, Björgulf was the only one of Erland's sons who did not seem to look up to him with blind love and boundless pride at calling him father. One morning, the two smallest boys noticed that Erland was reading from the prayer book and fasting on bread and water. They asked him why he was doing this, since it wasn't a fast day. Erland replied that it was because of his sins. Kristin knew that these fast days were part of the penance that had been imposed upon Erlan for breaking his marriage vows with Suniva Olaf's daughter, and she knew that her oldest sons were aware of this. Nokfa and Gauta seemed untroubled by it, but she happened to glance at Björgulf at that moment. The boy was sitting at the table, squinting nearsightedly at his bowl of food and chuckling to himself. Kristin had seen Gunnulf smile that way several times when Erland was being most boastful. She didn't like it. Now it was Nokfa whom Erland always wanted to take along. And the youth seemed to come alive, as if all his roots were attached to his father. Nokfa served his father the way a young page serves his lord and chieftain. He took care of his father's horse himself and kept his harness work and weapons in order. He fastened Erland's spurs on his feet and brought his hat and cape when Erland was going out. He filled his father's goblet and served him slices of meat at the table, sitting on the bench just to the right of Erland's seat. Erland jested a bit over the boy's chivalrous and noble manners, but he was pleased, and he commanded more and more of Nokfa's attention. Kristin saw that Erland had now completely forgotten how she had struggled and begged to win from him a scrap of fatherly love for this child. And Nokfa had forgotten the time when she was the one he turned to, seeking solace from all his ills and advice for all his troubles when he was little. He had always been a loving son toward his mother, and he still was in many ways, but she felt that the older the boy became, the farther away he moved from her and her concerns. Nokva lacked all sense for what she had to cope with. He was never disobliging when she gave him a task to do, but he was oddly awkward and clumsy at anything that might be called farm work. He did the chores without interest or desire and never finished anything. His mother thought that in many ways he was not unlike his deceased half-brother, Orm Erlandsson. He also resembled him in appearance. But Nokva was strong and healthy, a lively dancer and sportsman, an excellent bowman, and tolerably skilled in the use of other weapons, a good horseman and a superb skier. Kristin spoke about this one day to Ulf Haldorsson, Nokva's foster father. Ulf said, "No one has lost more from Erland's folly than that boy. There is not another youth growing up in Norway today who would make a more splendid horseman and chieftain than Nokva." But Kristin saw that Nokva never gave a thought to what his father had ruined for him. At that time, there was once again great unrest in Norway, and rumors were flying all through the valleys, some of them reasonable and some of them completely unlikely. The noblemen in the south and west of the kingdom, as well as in the uplands, had grown exceedingly discontented with the rule of King Magnus. It was said they had even threatened to take up arms, rally the peasantry, and force Lord Magnus Eiriksson to rule in accordance with their wishes and advice. Otherwise they would proclaim his cousin, the young Jong Hofterson of Suderheim, their king. His mother, Lady Ongnes, was the daughter of the blessed King Håkon Hallug. Not much was heard from Jon himself, but his brother Sigurd was supposed to be in the vanguard of the entire enterprise, and Bjarne, Erling Vidkunsson's young son, was also part of it. People said that Sigurd had promised that if Jon became king, he would take one of Bjarne's sisters as his queen, because the maidens of Giske were also descended from the ancient Norwegian kings. Sir Ivar Åkmundsson, who had formerly been one of King Magnus' most ardent supporters, was now said to have joined forces with these young noblemen, as had many others among the wealthiest and most high-born of men. People said that Erling Vidkunsson himself and the Bishop of Bjørgvin stood behind the effort. Kristin paid little mind to these rumors. She thought bitterly that she and her family were commoners now, and the affairs of the realm no longer concerned them. And yet she had talked about this a bit with Simon Andersson during the previous fall, and she also knew that he had spoken of it to Erland. But she saw that Simon was loath to discuss such things, partly, no doubt, because he disapproved of his brothers getting involved in such dangerous matters, and Geird, at any rate, was being led along by his wife's kinsmen. But Simon also feared that it wouldn't be pleasant for Erland to hear such talk since he had been born to take his place among men who counseled the rulers of Norway. But now misfortune had shut him out from the company of his peers. And yet Kristin saw that Erland spoke of these matters with his sons. One day she heard Nokva say, "But if these men win out against King Magnus, then surely they can't be so cowardly, father, that they wouldn't take up your case and force the king to make amends with you." Erland laughed. His son continued, "You were the first to show the way to these men and remind them that it was never the custom among Norwegian nobles in the past to sit back calmly and tolerate injustice from their kings. It cost you your ancestral estates and your position as sheriff. The men who supported you escaped without a scratch. You alone have paid the price for all of them."
"Yes, and that's all the more reason why they would want to forget me," said Erland with a laugh. "And the archbishopric has acquired Husaby against a loan. I don't think the gentlemen of the council will urge impoverished King Magnus to redeem it."
"The other king is your kinsman, as are Sigurd Hofterson and most of the other men," replied Nokva vehemently. "Not without shame can they desert the man who carried his shield with honor to the borderlands of the Nork and cleared Finnmark and the Gonvik coast of the enemies of God and the crown. Then they would indeed be miserable cowards."
Erland gave a whistle. "Son, one thing I can tell you. I don't know how this venture of the Hoftersons will end, but I would wager my own neck they don't dare show Lord Magnus the naked blade of a Norwegian sword. Talk and compromise are what I think will result, with not a single arrow fired. And those fellows won't exert themselves for my sake, because they know me and realize that I'm not as squeamish about honed steel as some of the others."
"Kinsmen, you say?"
"Yes, they're your third cousins, both Magnus and those sons of Hoftor. I remember them from the time I served at King Håkon's court. It was fortunate that my kinswoman Lady Agnes was the daughter of a king. Otherwise, she might have found herself out on the wharves, pulling in fish, if a woman like your mother, out of pious mercy, didn't hire her to help out in the cowshed. More than once I've wiped the snouts of those Hoftersons when they had to appear before their grandfather, and they came racing into the hall as snot-nosed as if they had just crept from their mother's lap. And if I gave them a swat out of loving kinship to teach them some proper manners, they would shriek like stuck pigs. I hear they've made men of these Suderheim changelings at last. But if you expect to receive the help of kinsmen from those quarters, you'd be looking for solace in the backside of a dog."
Later, Kristin said to Erland, "Nokva is so young, my dear husband. Don't you think it's unwise to speak so openly about such matters with him?"
"You speak so gently, my dear wife," replied Erland with a smile, "that I see you wish to rebuke me. When I was Nokva's age, I was headed north to Vargr for the first time. If Lady Ingebjerg had remained loyal to me," he exclaimed vehemently, "I would have sent Nokva and Gauta to serve her. In Denmark, there might have been a future for two intrepid adventurers skilled with weapons."
"When I gave birth to these children," said Kristin bitterly, "I didn't think that our sons would seek their living in a foreign land."
"You know I didn't intend that either," said Erland. "But man proposes, God disposes."
Then Kristin told herself that it wasn't simply that she felt a stab in her heart every time she noticed that Erland and her sons, now that they were getting older, acted as if their concerns were beyond the comprehension of a woman. But she feared Erland's reckless tongue. He never remembered that his sons were little more than children. And yet, as young as the boys were, Nikolaus was now 17 winters old, Bjørgulf would be 16, and Gauta would turn 15 in the fall. All three had a certain way with women that made their mother uneasy. Admittedly, nothing had happened that she could point to. They didn't run after women, they were never coarse or discourteous in speech, and they didn't like it when the servant men told vulgar stories or brought filthy rumors back to the manor. But Erland, too, had always been very chivalrous and seemly. She had seen him blush at words over which both her father and Simon laughed heartily. but at the time she had vaguely felt that the other two laughed the way peasants laugh at tales about the devil, while learned men, who know better his ferocious cunning, have little affection for such jests. Even Erland could not be called guilty of the sin of running after women. Only people who didn't know the man would think he had loose ways, meaning that he had lured women to himself and then deliberately led them astray. She never denied that Erland had had his way with her without resorting to seductive arts and without using deceit or force. And she was certain that it was not Erland who had done the seducing in the case of the two married women with whom he had sinned. But when loose women approached him with bold and provocative manners, she had seen him turn into an inquisitive youth. An air of concealed and impetuous frivolity would come over the man. With anguish, she thought she could see that the sons of Erlon took after their father in this regard. They always forgot to think about how others would judge them before they acted, although afterward they would take whatever was said to heart. And when women greeted them with smiles and gentleness, they didn't become shy or sullen or awkward, as did most young boys their age. They would smile back and talk and behave as freely and easily as if they had been at the king's court and were familiar with royal customs. Kristen feared they would get mixed up in some misfortune or trouble out of sheer innocence. She thought the wealthy wives and daughters, as well as the poor serving women, were all much too flirtatious with these handsome boys. But like other young men, they would grow furious afterward if anyone teased them about a woman. Frida Stierkar's daughter was particularly fond of doing this. She was a foolish woman, in spite of her age. She wasn't much younger than her mistress, and she had given birth to two bastard children. She had had difficulty even finding the father of the younger child. But Kristen had offered the poor thing a protective hand. Because Frida had nursed Björgulf and Skúla with such care and affection, the mistress was quite indulgent toward this serving maid, even though she was annoyed that the woman was always talking to the boys about young maidens. Kristen now thought it would be best if she could marry off her sons at a young age, but she knew this wouldn't be easy. The men whose daughters would be equal matches for Nokva and Björgulf by birth and blood would not think her sons wealthy enough, and the condemnation and royal enmity their father had brought down upon himself would stand in the way if the boys tried to improve their lot through service with greater noblemen. With bitterness, she thought about the days when Erland and Erling Vidkunsson had spoken of a marriage between Nokva and one of the lord's daughters. She knew of one or another young maiden now growing up in the valleys who might be suitable, wealthy and of good lineage, although for several generations their forefathers had refrained from serving at the king's court and had stayed home in their parishes. But she couldn't bear the thought that Erland might be refused if they should make an offer to one of these landowners. In this situation, Simon Dara would have been the best spokesman, but now Erland had deprived them of his help. She didn't think any of her sons had a desire to serve the church, except perhaps Gauta or Lavrans. But Lavrans was still so young, and Gauta was the only one of the boys who gave her any real help with the estate. Storms and snow had wreaked havoc with the fences that year, and the snowfall before Holy Cross Day had delayed the repairs, so the workers had to press hard to finish in time. For this reason, Kristen sent Nokva and Björgulf off one day to mend the fence around a field up near the main road. In mid-afternoon, Kristen went out to see how the boys were handling the unaccustomed chore. Björgulf was working over by the lane leading to the manor. She stopped for a while to talk with him. Then she continued northward. There she saw Nokva leaning over the fence and talking to a woman on horseback who had stopped at the side of the road, right next to the rails. He stroked the horse and then grabbed the girl's ankle, moving his hand, as if carelessly, up her leg under her clothing. The maiden was the first to notice Kristen. She blushed and said something to Nokva. Quickly he pulled his hand away and looked a little abashed. The girl was about to ride off, but Kristen called out a greeting and then talked to the maiden for a moment, asking about her kinswoman. The young girl was the niece of the mistress of Ulvsvold and had recently arrived for a visit. Kristen pretended that she hadn't seen anything, talking to Nokva about the fence after the maiden had gone. Not long after, Kristen happened to stay at Ulvsvold for 2 weeks' time because the mistress